a third case for today, 98-2196, State v. Bolig. Mr. Nafi, you are appearing representing Bolig, Mr. Bolig. You may proceed.
May it please the court. In this case, George Bolig pled no contest to attempted first-degree sexual assault of a child. However, before he was sentenced, he moved the court to withdraw that plea. The trial court, after a hearing, denied his motion, and Mr. Bolig appealed that ruling. There were two errors made at the plea hearing. First, the trial court failed to notify Mr. Bolig of each of the three elements of the crime to which he was pleading. Secondly, the trial court failed to notify Mr. Bolig that he would have to register as a sex offender under the Wisconsin sex offender registration and notification laws as a result of his conviction. These two errors made Mr. Bolig's plea not knowing, not voluntarily, not intelligently made. One way of putting it, I guess. With regard to these issues on appeal, the Court of Appeals held, with respect to the first issue, the trial court did err. It failed to notify Mr. Bolig of each of the three elements of the crime of attempted first-degree sexual contact with a child. But it was not reversible error because other factors in the record indicated that Mr. Bolig knew or should have known what the elements were. With regard to the second error, that being the failure to notify him that he would have to register as a sex offender, the Court of Appeals made three important findings. First, it found that the sex registration laws in Wisconsin were a direct result of pleading guilty to this crime or no contest. Secondly, the Court of Appeals found that being convicted and having to register was not punitive, and therefore the trial court did not have to tell Mr. Bolig of this consequence at the time of the plea. Lastly, the Court of Appeals found that even if Mr. Bolig was able to show a fair and just reason for withdrawing his plea, he failed to carry the burden of proof, that proof being that the state did not suffer substantial prejudice. It's these last two findings that I want to discuss today. With respect to the punitive issue, that being whether or not the sex offender registration laws and notification laws are punitive, the question for determination is, are Wisconsin sex offender registration notification laws punitive? Because if they are, defendants pleading guilty to sex offense must be informed, otherwise their plea is not knowing, voluntarily, intelligently made as required by the Due Process Clause. It becomes a question now, how do we determine whether or not sections 301, 45, and 46 are punishment? This court, the Supreme Court of the United States also, has never expressly held what law should we apply to determine whether or not these types of laws are punishment. They have many times held out for us what tests should be applied to determine whether a particular statute is punitive or simply remedial. Usually this is done in the context of double jeopardy claims, ex post facto claims, excessive fines or forfeiture claims, but never in the sex offender registration area.
Counsel, I believe that everyone else can be wrong and you can be right. But you've got, with regard to other precedent on that issue, a bit of a uphill battle. As I count the states, one state would agree with you on that issue, and a stack of states disagree with you on that issue. Why should we set aside the many, many states that have addressed that issue and found contrary to your position?
I think there's four reasons why this court should follow California and not these other states. Number one is, obviously, none of those state court opinions are binding on this court. That's a simple answer.
Sure, and I know that.
These other states...
Rationale.
Right. These other decisions come from states that have really totally different regulatory sex offender schemes than Wisconsin does. Theirs are much more tightly tailored to meet a remedial purpose. They only require certain sex offenders to register. They give those sex offenders the right to petition to be relieved from the duty. They do a risk assessment to figure out whether or not these offenders are likely to reoffend. Therefore, the law makes sense. In Wisconsin, we don't have that. We apply it to a broad range of sex crimes, including false imprisonment, kidnapping, and then a whole rash of sex offenses. We allow access to the public, to law enforcement. What does the public need it for if it's totally geared towards remedial purposes? These other states all have extremely tailored statutes. They say that only law enforcement gets the information. It's kept confidential. It's you have the right to petition for a hearing. You get due process rights at that hearing. The other thing is, a lot of these other courts...
So it's your representation to the court that Wisconsin is unique in its breadth of the statute.
It's my representation that it's different than all of the other states that have found that it's punitive.
In what way is it different? In what way does it differ from the majority of the other states?
The majority of the other states that have found it to be punitive, the statute clearly indicates what the legislative intent is, and it's for rehabilitation. The other states also have a right to petition to be relieved from the duty. The other states have safety guards as to who gets the information. Here in Wisconsin, all you have to do is call up an 800 number, and everybody can get the information. Also, Wisconsin has a requirement in certain cases that bulletins be posted. That's different than the other states.
Counsel, let me just stop you at this point. It was my understanding that all of the laws in the other states have, and including Wisconsin, have the same genesis. In other words, they all come from what was originally called Megan's Law, which evolved from a particular case, and if I remember, it was from New Jersey. How do you really believe that these statutes are so completely different, one from the other, having the same genesis to begin with?
I do, because I've looked at them. Many of the states, New Jersey's decision, I think it was in, I can't remember the name of the case, but it sets forth the statute. They have three tiers. If you're a tier one, there's no public dissemination of the information. If you're, then there's a risk assessment done. You have a right to a hearing. If you're found to be a tier two, then you have certain information disseminated to law enforcement. And if you're tier three, then there's public dissemination to the public as well. And different information depending on what tier you're under. The other thing is, Wisconsin has such a broad range of crimes that are included in this statute. For instance, many of the other states' state rulings rely on Ward out of Washington. Most of the western states follow Ward. Ward was a constitutional challenge on ex post facto grounds. There was many constraints on both the registration requirements, very few laws, only felonies, and notification was a three-tiered analysis. There was a right to petition to be relieved, And central to the finding the law being punitive was the fact that all persons had an opportunity to be relieved from the duty. There was, and this shows that there was this legislative intent, and the effect of the law is remedial. There's no punishment involved when you have these rights to be relieved from it, and only information that's necessary. If you don't need this information to rehabilitate or to protect society, the public, what are they going to do with it? They're going to use it like shaming punishments, like in the colonial times. Law enforcement, yes, I think that's a good idea. I want to emphasize, I'm not weighing the rights of the defendant against the rights of the victims. I'm just saying that the other states that the prosecution has cited have significantly different sex offender registration laws.
Well, it's my understanding that, for instance, if you're a juvenile in Wisconsin and found delinquent as a result of having committed a sex offense, that you can be, under the law, relieved of the requirement of registration. Is that significant, the difference between the way adults and juveniles are treated?
Yes, I think that's very significant. This court in State versus Hezier found that it wasn't punishment for that very fact that you could be waived, or the court could waive that requirement. For adults, under 301, 45, and 46, there is no right to waive it. And I think that indicates that there's a punitive element to this statutory scheme.
Well, punitive element isn't sufficient, though. I mean, you need more than just a punitive element. A lot of things can be punitive, but also remedial and still not be classified overall as punitive, right? I mean, it has to be, I forget the wording, but something like so punitive in nature and effect as to constitute punishment.
Exactly. I think the intent, the subjective intent of the legislature here is about neutral. There's a specific statute, 301.001, that controls the purpose of this statute. It controls the purpose of chapters 301 through 304. There's nothing in there that declares this to be remedial, and there's nothing in there that declares this to be punitive. It's interesting to note that those chapters also house probation, parole, prison, and the sex offender laws. So I think the intent prong of the intent effects test is about neutral. It's the effect or the impact where this law sways towards being punitive. I think there's at least three reasons why it does that.
Go finish your thought.
First is, these laws, public humiliation, public notification by governments, have always been traditionally looked upon as being punitive. I think in my briefs I've laid out pretty sufficiently what the shaming laws, shaming punishments, were intended for and what the effect was. The second reason I think the effect is punitive is, until recently, we had to guess what the actual effect is, but now, because of a study done by two professors at Marquette, funded by the National Institute of Justice, we know what the impact in Wisconsin is. 23 of the 30 offenders had problems finding housing. Others had problem with their employment. Others had problems being harassed, telephone calls, car being spray painted, job loss. I think it's pretty clear that the actual effect in Wisconsin of these statutes is punishment. These people are being punished.
Maybe they're being punished for their original crime.
I would agree that the sentence for the crime or the conviction has some short-term punishment, but over the long course, I think that fades. And like the court in California says, these laws require defendants or convicts to carry this badge of infamy with them for at least 15 years and perhaps life. The information is also, the difference I think is, the government goes out and publishes the information. It posts the bulletins. with just the conviction, sure, that is public record and people can get it, but it's not affirmatively given to the public by the government. And
could I ask a question?
Certainly.
The law applies, if I'm not mistaken, to people who were convicted before the law took effect. Isn't that
correct.
Right? Now, let's assume you're correct. This is punishment. How would that ruling apply to people who were convicted before the law took effect? What would be their remedy?
They're not going to be able to withdraw their pleas because time is run. That would be probably an ex post facto challenge to the law. I'm not certain, to be honest with you, Justice Prosser. I've given a lot of thought to that issue, and I frankly haven't really found a good solution to it. I understand that people that have been convicted long before are going to be subject to the same crime. But I don't think that changes the fact that, as applied to Mr. Bolig and those that weren't notified at the time of their plea hearings, it is punitive.
Why aren't you arguing? You're arguing that it's punitive. The Court of Appeals said it wasn't punitive. The Court of Appeals, however, did not address a prior argument of yours. That is, the Court of Appeals did not decide whether the failure to notify the defendant that he'd be required to register as a sex offender was a fair and just reason for withdrawal. Under the law, as I understand it, fair and just reason, we're talking about pre-sentence withdrawal, is to be, yes, maybe I could even say liberally granted, or it's a very low standard. As set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion, it says, however, Bolig points out that our conclusion that these are not punishments does not answer the question of whether offered a fair and just reason for moving to withdraw the plea. The standard for withdrawing the plea prior to sentencing is quite low. It contemplates a mere showing of some adequate reason for the defendant's change of heart. I mean, this is low. So why aren't you arguing that?
I was just getting to it.
Oh. So why didn't you stop me?
The Court of Appeals did hold that this was non-punitive, but it went on to say, like Justice Bradley just said, maybe it is still a just and fair reason to allow Mr. Bolig to withdraw. But the court also said, even if it is a fair and just reason, he hasn't carried the burden of proving the lack of substantial prejudice to the state. And
no, if I may interrupt, you're not arguing that. You're going to what you said was your second issue, which dealt with the allocation of burden. I submit that's a non-issue because the state has conceded the trial that the Court of Appeals made a mistake. The state will correct me but I think I read verbatim. They conceded that they made a mistake with regard to the burden of proof. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about not the burden of proof, but whether or not the defendant offered a fair and just reason for moving to withdraw the plea, realizing that you don't have to show much, according to case law. Why don't you argue that? I mean, that's okay. You can just say it's not a good argument. That's an okay answer, but
the reason I wasn't arguing it was because I thought that the Court of Appeals said it was a fair and just reason, but then they said you don't only have to show that, but you also have to show a lack of substantial prejudice, and that's where we lost.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that the Court of Appeals agreed with my argument that it was a fair and just reason. If they didn't, I guess that's news to me, and I should make it clear that the failure to notify Mr. Bolig of this requirement to register, I think, rises to this very low level of being a fair and just reason. It is more than just wanting a new trial. It is more than just a change of heart. It is realizing, hey, I'm going to have to register immediately. If I don't, I'm going to be convicted of another crime, and I'm going to have to carry this around with me for at least the next 15 years. And there were other reasons why he wanted to withdraw his plea as well. He felt coerced. He didn't realize that one of the elements of the crime was that the touching of the child had to be for sexual gratification. It was his argument that was brought out at the motion hearing that he was cradling the child's buttock, and that to him wasn't a sexual act, but to the authorities it was.
One of the things that I found, you know, your client, he acted as his own counsel, and then he had three different counsel, and then he would enter, go through the motion. The motion would be to withdraw his plea, and it seems to me that he came up with, quote, different reasons each time, and you're saying that this harassment, he felt that he was being coerced into the plea. He didn't make that originally, did he?
Yeah, that was actually his first motion.
And but he kept, what I found interesting, he kept adding on as he would change counsel.
There were four motions to withdraw the plea. Two were ruled upon. That was the first one, the one where he felt coerced by his lawyer. The lawyer was allowed to withdraw.
That was Benavides was first.
Yes.
Right?
And then I think it was Bennett.
Bennett was next.
He filed one himself, and then Croak filed the last one. The last three all raise this issue of 301.45. The first one raised the issue of being coerced, the issue of not being informed of the three elements of the crime. Court entertained it. There was a written decision on the 301.45 withdrawal motion, part of the record.
Counsel, if I might, let me go back to one of the arguments made by the state in regard to the registration requirement and give you a chance to address that. That argument is that the Court of Appeals was wrong when the Court of Appeals said that this is a direct consequence, the registration requirement. And as I understand the state is arguing that it really is a collateral consequence. That it really is something that is not automatic or immediate. It's something that is faced in the future. How do you handle that argument?
It's my understanding that collateral consequences are consequences that require something to happen in the future to bring about the consequence. Like in 980, there's got to be a hearing at some point down the road. Or in administrative suspension. Something happens at a later date to cause the sentence to occur. In this case, your sentence within 10 days, there's no hearings, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You are registered as a sex offender. And it's automatic, it's immediate, and it's not contingent upon any other facts occurring.
When do you actually have to register?
Within 10 days of being sentenced. And then again, within 10 days after you're released from incarceration, and then annually for 15 years. And if you reoffend at any time, or if you've got a prior offense, you've got to register for life. And that requires a notice every time you move, every time you buy a new automobile, every time you get a new job. All that information is available. 800 number.
Let me ask, in some of these other states where the laws have been upheld, but where you say that the purpose of the laws is different, have there been studies to indicate whether any of those under the people under those laws have been humiliated?
I'm not aware of any that directly answer that question, but there's been two studies that are out of Western states that indicate that whether or not you have sex registration, sex offender registration, does not help protect society to any statistical degree. Whether you have it or don't have it, it doesn't really matter. All you're doing is keeping the honest offenders honest. The ones that want to offend are going to offend. And whether they register or not doesn't make any difference. The only study that I'm aware of that looks at whether or not people are being humiliated is the Wisconsin study. And it shows that people are being humiliated, harassed, and out of housing, out of jobs because of this law.
But there are laws that have been upheld. And it would seem to me what you're trying to imply here is that perhaps in other states, defendants are not being humiliated, are not having trouble with their housing, are not having trouble with their jobs, are not being harassed. And is that really, I mean, do you have any evidence to support that conclusion?
I didn't actually mean to imply that. What I meant to imply was that their laws were different, and that their laws, as tailored, evidenced a remedial, a solely remedial purpose. Our law, because it's not so tailored, evidences a punitive intent and a punitive, more so, a punitive effect or impact.
Counsel, your time's up. I just want one question. What is your strongest argument here?
The burden of proof. Shifting to the defendant. I think there was a fair and just reason. He should have been allowed to withdraw the plea because of that fact alone. And I think the 301-45 argument is just about equally as strong.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Attorney General William Wolfert, arguing for the state.
May it please the court, I'm William C. Wolfert representing the state in this case. I'm going to address the issues relating to defendant's claim that he should have been able to withdraw his plea because he wasn't told of the sex offender registration requirement, and the issue relating to the denial of his plea because of the finding that by the trial court that there was prejudice to the state. I'm not going to be addressing the last issue in defendant's brief unless the court has questions about it.
Last issue being the elements of the offense only.
That's correct.
Two elements.
That's correct. Defendant contends he's entitled to withdraw his no contest plea because he wasn't advised prior to the plea he would have to register as a sex offender. He contends this makes his plea unknowing and involuntary, and therefore he's entitled to withdraw it as a matter of right. The Court of Appeals rejected this claim. The Court of Appeals ruled that a trial court is not required to notify a defendant of this registration requirement in order to be valid. We believe the Court of Appeals was correct in reaching this conclusion. The defendant has a due process right to be advised of the direct consequences of a plea, but not collateral consequences. Under James and Dugan, cited by the Court of Appeals, a consequence is only direct if the result represents a definite, immediate, and largely automatic effect on the range of the defendant's punishment. Thus, the question in this case is whether registration as a sex offender is punishment. Now, how do you determine whether the statute constitutes punishment? Well, Dugan considered whether restitution was punishment. They didn't rely in that case on the intent effects case, which is advocated by the defendant, but the analysis is fairly consistent because the court concluded that a statute wasn't punitive simply because it had some punitive effects. The court focused on the primary purpose of the statute. If you use the intent effects test, which is used for double jeopardy analysis, the statute also doesn't constitute punishment. I'd first like to address the legislative intent.
Sorry, if I may, just for clarification, I'd like to know if you interpret the Court of Appeals opinion the way that the defendant does. In response to some of my questions, the defendant said that he didn't think he had to argue the fair and just reason because the Court of Appeals decided in his favor that there was a fair and just reason. Do you interpret the Court of Appeals opinion in that fashion?
Well, I think it's a little unclear. I think the Court of Appeals was implicitly saying that it probably was a fair and just reason, but because of the prejudice component, it was within the discretion of the trial court to reject the plea.
I need help on this. I note that on page 2 you say the Court of Appeals did not decide whether the failure to notify the defendant that he would be required to register as a sex offender was a fair and just reason for withdrawing his plea before sentencing. And so that's confusing to me because that's what's said in your brief, and yet you seem to say now that they did decide it.
Well,
I'm just trying to understand.
They didn't explicitly decide it. What I'm really saying, I guess, is that we are not really disputing the fact that it might be a fair and just reason. Of course, always when you're dealing with a fair and just reason, it has to be the real reason. The court has to believe that that is the reason that they want to withdraw their plea. But we're not saying if someone truly has not been advised of sex offender registration requirement, they want to withdraw their plea before sentencing, it probably is a fair and just reason. But there is this prejudice component to it that has to be considered. And in this case, the trial court correctly decided that there was a reason to deny withdrawal because of the prejudice component.
So you're saying the trial court correctly did the prejudice component. You're conceding that the Court of Appeals incorrectly assessed the burden on the prejudice, no?
Yes, I am. That was an issue that really wasn't discussed in the Court of Appeals by either party, the prejudice component, and the court in writing its decision just imposed the burden on the state, and we believe that that was incorrect, but in this case, it doesn't make any difference.
Imposed the burden on the defendant.
I'm sorry, on the defendant to prove a negative, in essence.
Thanks.
Prove that there was no...
I just needed that clarification.
Now, as to the intent of the registration and notification law, I've cited legislative history in my brief and the appendix. It shows the primary purpose of the legislation was protection of the public and assistance in crime detection and prevention, not additional punishment. This was a work group report by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. It was in the drafting file for the law. Department of Corrections is the agency in charge of the law. I think it's entitled to great weight. In his reply brief, and indeed before this court today, the defendant argues that the legislative history should be ignored because of Section 301.001 of the statutes, which is a statement of purpose for Chapter 301. But in his original brief, page 15, footnote 3, he concedes that that statute was enacted years before the sex offender registration law even came into effect. So it can't be in any statement of legislative purpose of what the sex offender registration law was about. Another reason that shows that there was no punishment intended is that the statute is not included in the criminal code. Looking at the effects of the law, the defendant relies on United States versus Ursary, Supreme Court decision, for the intent effects test. Under that test, the defendant must show the clearest proof that the sanction at issue is so punitive in form and effect that it renders the statute criminal despite legislative intent to the contrary. We submit that there has been no such clearest proof offered in this case. Now, as to the study that was included in the defendant's appendix, he relies on that study to a great extent in showing that there's a punitive effect on offenders. I'd like to make several points about that. At page 16 of the defendant's brief, he cites United States versus Helper in support of that argument that civil sanctions can be punitive, in fact. Helper makes clear at footnote 7 of the opinion that whether a sanction constitutes punishment is not determined from the defendant's perspective. Sanctions often seem like punishment to an offender. If we were in the same situation, we would probably think they felt like punishment too, but that doesn't mean that they're legally punishment. Even under the study, most of the offenders said that registration was not a major impediment in their lives. That's at page 40 and 41 of the study. So I think the issue really relates largely to notification as opposed to registration. The study itself acknowledges at page 52 that the law's primary goal is community protection. The people that were interviewed for purpose of the study, they were offenders who were subject to community notification. And you would expect those were the people whose lives would be most impacted. But there are a minority of the offenders that are covered by this law. Not everyone is subject to community notification. In fact, under section 301.46, paren 2, paren E, not everyone is subject to community notification, and the local authorities make a determination on who should be based on the necessity to protect the public. The defendant says, why does the public need this information? This shows that it's punitive. Well, I mean, the reason the public needs the information is to protect themselves from sexual offenders. That's the remedial purpose of the statute. But it's not willy-nilly. Not everyone is subject to notification. There's been talk about vigilante activity and people taking the law into their own hands and harassing people. That's discouraged by the law. Section 939.646 is a penalty enhancer for crimes committed using information obtained from the sex offender registry. And in addition, I don't think it's really fair to attribute the actions of the public to the state. For purposes of this statute. The state is not trying to encourage this sort of activity at all. In fact, it makes their job more difficult.
Mr. Wolford, did you review the laws of the other states that have faced this issue?
I can't say that I'm familiar with the details of every law in depth. I can tell you that
I guess my question goes to whether or not you'd agree with opposing counsel that the statutes seem to be very different than the statute here in the state of Wisconsin.
I think all the laws are somewhat different from each other, but you know these laws resulted from federal action in 1996, where the Congress asked the states to enact laws establishing procedures where police agencies would tell a community resident when an offender moved in, or they would face loss of federal funds. So, you know, most of the states are going to have notification of some sort, and how they differ in specific detail, I can't really say. There are other cases that I didn't cite in my brief that deal with community notification in an ex post facto context as opposed to the collateral direct issue, and have upheld the statute as those statute as well. I'd be happy to supply those if the court would like them, but they weren't directly on point to the issue. I don't think that on this record that it's appropriate to conclude that we should decide that this statute is punitive because of difference between the laws.
Doesn't it really boil down to we don't have a very good test to determine what's punitive and what isn't?
Well, it's not an exact test, but I think that this particular statute is, it certainly has some deterrent aspects. Most regulatory statutes do, but I think it clearly is largely remedial, and that's the primary purpose, to protect the public. I'd also point out there's no affirmative restraint under the statute. A person can be subject to registration or notification even if they're found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, so it's not aimed specifically at people who have been convicted of crimes. Now, finally, I'd like to respond to this issue relating to the shaming punishments, the comparison of these statutes to shaming punishments. Certainly, in colonial times, shaming was often intended as punishment, and indeed sometimes that was the only punishment that a person would suffer. But it involved more than dissemination of information. There was little need for dissemination in colonial society because everyone knew everyone else, and they knew what a person had done. It also generally involved direct confrontation between the offender and the community. That's not what happens under this statute. If the local law enforcement officer decides this particular sex offender, they should do some sort of community notification or they should have a community meeting, they don't bring the defendant in front of the group and expose them to the community. That's really not the humiliation is not the purpose behind this statute. So for these reasons, I would request that you conclude the failure of the trial court to advise the defendant that they had to register as a sex offender is not a basis to entitle the defendant to withdraw the plea as a matter of right. Then I'd like to get into the issue of the prejudice.
Of the what? I'm sorry.
The prejudice issue. We conceded in our brief that the Court of Appeals in its decision indicated that the defendant bore the burden, and we think that the state should have to bear it after the defendant first shows a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea. This rule is consistent with the ABA standard and with the practice under Rule 32 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. But even though we think the Court of Appeals used the wrong standard in this case, we think that the decision of the trial court in this case was correct. The trial court didn't decide this case on the basis that the defendant hadn't met the burden of showing no prejudice to the state. The court simply looked at the record and reached the conclusion that there was going to be prejudice in this case. The court was aware of the delay. The court was aware of the age of the witness, which was probably less than 5 years old, and I think this was a reasonable decision to make. I don't think that we should require that there be evidence put on in every case where the issue is pretty apparent. I've also cited two statutes in my brief which show a legislative recognition of trauma to the victim and a need to move these cases along so that that doesn't hang over a victim's head, particularly when it's a child. So, unless there are any further questions, I would request that the decision of the Court of Appeals be upheld in this case.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I went back and looked at my notes regarding the laws of these other states. The prosecution of the state has cited 12 different cases from 12 different states. 7 of those states have no public dissemination. It's only for law enforcement. 8 of those cases dealt with the issue of ex post facto application of law. As far as the legislative intent goes, I presume that the legislature knew that 301.001 existed at the time that it chose by Act 440 to place this statutory scheme into that chapter. The fact that it wasn't in the criminal code, I don't think really makes any difference. I'm sure if I was standing here arguing that it was punitive just because it was in the criminal code, I wouldn't carry a whole lot of weight. As far as my study goes, I think the state misspoke. On page 40 and 41 of the study, they're not talking about the impact of the sex registration law. They're talking about answering the questions of the registrator. That was minimal. That was slightly embarrassing. Giving the DNA sample was similarly minimally invasive. But the impact of registration and notification is set out in my reply brief. I've got a lot of examples of how it's impacted. And table 6 to the study shows that there's been a grave impact by this sex registration and notification. So just answering the questions, yeah, that might not have been a big deal to the sex offenders, but the actual impact once they're released from prison has been really good. It's been really grave, I mean. As far as the shaming punishments, they're making a big comeback, especially on the West Coast. I lived in San Diego. I practiced in California for 5 years, and trust me, people are being ordered to wear signs saying they're repeat drunk drivers or they're repeat sex offenders, billboards, signs on their apartment doors. The reason they're making a comeback is because they're effective. Public humiliation works. It deters. It punishes. As far as the intent and the effect test goes, I think we're probably stuck with that. We've used it before in other areas of the law. I would say that it's very important to look at the effect prong and not just the intent prong. I understand you have to overcome the intent if there's a clearly stated intent, but I think it's just neutral. Lastly, on the burden of proof argument, I think the trial court just did a simple balancing test, and I'm not aware of any laws that allow burdens to be carried by just presumptions of the trial court judge.
What about the legislative intent that is contained in the statutes that says essentially kids of tender age in these kinds of cases, the cases have to move along, otherwise kids experience trauma?
That document that the state attached to its brief was drafted in 1994. There's no evidence that it was relied upon. It's overcome by the specific statute in the chapter. And lastly, the language in there, I think, could be
case, as you started earlier, was attacking the elements issue here. That's the second issue that you said you wanted to address. How can you... Don't you have Prop, Bangert opinion, and that Brandt opinion that was issued by this court last year that essentially says, look, you know, the trial court judge is confined to the colloquy, but the trial court judge can look at signed statements, including plea advisement and waiver of rights form, which is an issue here. If you combine that in, don't you have problems in making your argument?
No, not at all. I think Brandt helps my case. Brandt says if it is shown that the judge took time to talk to the defendant about the fact that he signed this plea agreement and the rights are given up in there, then it can be relied upon. In this case, the evidence was actually that he had signed the plea agreement 4 months earlier when he was going to plea the first time, and there was no reliance on it.
My recollection of Brandt is that says, you know, there are various ways of doing it, and the list in Bangard isn't exhaustive and does not require an extensive verbal colloquy. You can just rely on the written record.
There has to be some showing that there's reliance on the signed plea agreement, and there is none in this case. All that happened was that the judge asked if he went through it, and said yes. There's no showing that he understood the three elements. In fact, the evidence was just the opposite, the fact that he didn't understand that the element of sexual gratification had to be proven by beyond a reasonable doubt by the state. There's no other questions, I thank you.
Yes, Justice Brasser.
If we assume there was a fair and just reason for withdrawing the plea, and if we assume that the burden to show substantial prejudice is on the state, you win automatically?
I think so. They didn't prove it. I don't think they could have proven it. They would have had to bring in some, put on some evidence at least. It was on their shoulders to do so, and they didn't. I don't think it's fair to just presume that they could have. And I don't think there's time now to go back and have a hearing. I don't think that will remedy the situation. The evidence now is certainly a lot different than it was back at the time of this motion.
Yeah, but the prejudice here was the child was getting older, and therefore the recollection would be harder to come by, and that it was going to be stale. Isn't that the prejudice?
Yes, I think that was the prejudice, but whether or not that was real or not,
how would you show that? How would you show that?
How would the state have shown it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You could have had the child interviewed by a professional, given a rendered opinion. They could have voir dired the child in chambers. I think there's ways to do it.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolford. That ends the oral argument on the third case and ends our sitting in Janesville.